This lesson is going to be on selling houses fast. And tonight we're going to discuss why houses don't sell. And then on the next lesson, we'll talk about a step-by-step program to effectively sell all kinds of houses at lightning speed. One of the most common things that people fear about getting into real estate is that they're afraid they can't sell the house, and somehow they'll get stuck with it. And I can understand why this will create anxiety for a beginner, because they simply don't have enough facts to overcome the fear. So let's see if we can't figure out how to fix that. And truth is, selling should be the easiest part of the business. Are you not buying because you're waiting to sell? Or is your income suffering because you haven't plugged a hole in the back end? Or are you afraid of selling so much that you never start buying? If any of that is true, and you're losing a large part of your income because of just a simple piece of the system that needs to be fixed, and that's the reason we're having the next couple of lessons, to see if we can't do something to fix those. In this lesson, I'll discuss the reasons why some people have trouble selling and how we can fix that. And then in the next lesson, and possibly even the next two lessons, we're going to have a step-by-step process for selling wholesale deals and or cash outs to qualified buyers, or if we want to sell them to by owner financing or by lease optioning, that's a different exit strategy as well. So in this lesson, we're going to talk about why the houses don't sell, and there's actually 14 reasons why that I've identified. And pay real close attention to numbers 4 through 7 as we go through these, because in reality, they equal about 80% of why houses don't sell, aren't sold very quickly. Most of the time, it's a people problem and not a house problem. And we can fix people problems, and we can fix some house problems. And as we go through, we'll decide which ones we can fix and which ones we can't fix. So why houses don't sell quickly? Here's the list. I'll go over the list, and then I will come back and we'll cover each one of them individually. Number one, the house is not ready to sell. Number two, it's in a poor area. Number three, it's overpriced. Number four, it's a salesman's personality problem. Number five, inflexibility of the seller. Number six, salesperson's lack of knowledge about financing programs available. Or number seven, salesperson's lack of knowledge about attracting and pre-screening leads. Or eight, no follow-up system in place. Nine, functional obsolescence. 10, the house is very small. Number 11, the salesperson loses control of the loan process. Number 12, the house located too far away from the city. Or 13, houses in a high price range where few buyers can afford. Or number 14, it only has one bathroom. There's 14 reasons right there why houses don't sell. And as I said earlier, the biggest problems are going to lie between number 4 through 7, which were salesperson's personality problems, inflexibility of the seller, salesperson's lack of knowledge about financing problems, or salesperson's lack of knowledge about attracting and pre-screening leads. And all of those are people problems. Notice that the majority of these problems are directly related to the person and not the house. Okay, the first reason why houses don't sell, it's not ready to sell. When I renovate properties, or even when I don't renovate them, when I get them and they're supposedly in good shape, I go down this same list and I make sure that all of these things are fixed on the property if my intention is to sell it in good condition, and that is the case most of the time. However, some properties we will sell as is on a work for equity program, so some of this stuff won't apply because in that program it's a responsibility of our tenant buyer to do this stuff themselves. But if you're selling a house that's represented to be in good shape, you probably want to take heed of this list, because there's a difference between a house that's ready to sell and a house that some people think are ready to sell. First thing on the list is the front appearance. Would you want to see the inside? If you're driving up to this property and you looked at the front of the house, does your first impression make you want to come into the house? Is the house attractive from the front? Is it at least attractive enough to stim your curiosity enough to make you get out and go take a look at the inside? The roof, does it need replaced? If a roof is bad and it looks bad, it's one of the biggest turnoffs on a house, and you're going to have a very tough time getting an owner-occupant to buy a property when it's obvious that the roof needs to be replaced. And course, in addition to that, you're going to have a hard time getting your owner-occupant financed because the lender will require the roof to be replaced if it doesn't have at least 3 to 5 years remaining life on it as represented by the appraiser. So sometimes you'll have an opportunity to try to get by because the roof's got a few more years on it. And even if you can get by and satisfy the lender, ask yourself, is it really going to save you the price of putting a roof on there, or are you actually going to eat that cost up in holding costs anyway, trying to find a buyer who needs glasses and can't see that the roof really should be replaced? Third thing on the list is exterior paint. When I paint a house, I paint them at least two colors, sometimes three colors. I want the house to look fresh and freshly painted. I don't necessarily paint every single house that we renovated, but it has to be look like it's been painted not very long ago. Sometimes you can fix that with a pressure cleaner, but 90% of the properties that you will buy that need renovated are going to need to be painted on the exterior. I use two colors and sometimes three. I like a little trim. Sometimes I want the front door a different color than the two colors that I use on the house. Usually trim the house in one color and paint the rest of the house in another color. And when I see an opportunity, I add a third color. Number four is interior paint. I use at least two colors inside as well. I've seen houses that were painted totally white inside, look like a white tornado went through them, and they have no color whatsoever, and it's all flat, ugly-looking paint. In fact, that's how banks used to renovate houses. They just have somebody go in there and paint them all white, and it just had no appeal whatsoever. So I use at least two colors, and sometimes I use a third color in the house as well when I see a chance. Interior trim. Is there color in the house, or is it just blah? I like wallpaper borders. I like wallpaper. I like blinds, and I like blinds that are a little different color than the rest of the property. I used to use rose-colored blinds a lot when I was painting the walls with an off eggshell white or whatever. I want color in my bathrooms, and I want color in my kitchens. If not, at the very least, I want a border up there by the ceiling, a wallpaper border with some kind of nice-looking design in it that's not gaudy but adds a little color. Bath and kitchen accessories. A little bit of money spent in bathrooms and kitchens can make a lot of difference in the appearance of a house just by the little inexpensive fancy doodads that you can add to them and fancy lights and anything you can do to doll them up so that they are very attractive. I want the L-shaped levered doorknobs instead of the round doorknobs. They cost about $10 more than the round doorknobs, but they add a little class to the property. I want shower curtains and shower doors and just anything and everything on the inside of the house that I can think of that will make it look better without spending much money on it. The carpet. Is the carpet nice? Does the carpet attractive? Or is it some old blah, ugly color? In fact, a student taught me to use Hunter Green carpet. And at first I balked about that until I tried it in a house and discovered that it sold very quickly. And I said, well, it must have been a fluke. But so I tried it in the next house, and sure enough, it sold very quickly. A Hunter Green is a dark green. It's not an emerald green now. It's a Hunter Green. It's a dark, rich green, and it just really adds class to the property. And if you're going to paint the wall some eggshell color of white, it'll just pretty much match anything in the house. So ask yourself, would you want this carpet installed in your home? And if not, you probably don't want to put some of that cheap FHA grade brown, not-so-nice carpet in your houses just because you can and just because it's enough to get by. Remember, when people walk through the front door, they have to be pleased with what they see, and you don't want to try to override their senses. Does the house have central heat and air? Down here where I live in Florida, I wouldn't dream of putting a house on the market without central heat and air. It's an absolute requirement. HUD tenants require central heat and air down here. In two-thirds of the country, that's true. In an extreme north, it's not true. If it's customary not to have central heat and air, then it's not an issue up there. But I would not try to get by without installing central heat and air in a property if there are any properties in the neighborhood with it, and then I'm going to make sure that's in mine. Kitchens. Does the kitchen have plenty of cabinets, or are there just enough cabinets in the kitchen to get by? I always like to add as many kitchen cabinets as the kitchen will hold. Landscaping. Landscaping is one of the most inexpensive things you can do to the property, but it's pretty darn important. It goes back to the frontal appearance. I usually landscape the front of the property. I rarely do anything to the rest of the yard, but I want that front looking nice, and it only costs a few hundred dollars to get the front of most houses looking very nice. Now, your customers won't complain about shoddy repairs. They just won't buy the property. Many times they won't even tell you why. Sometimes they don't even know why. They just don't get a good feeling for it. So if it doesn't look good enough to satisfy your wife, your buyers won't like it either, guys. Spend a few more dollars and make it a house you can be proud to sell and know that your buyer will rave to other people about it, not one that you're going to have to show and show and show and show and keep on the market. Remember, your holding costs will quickly override your repair costs if you try to skimp here. Make sure the property is ready to sell. If you do, amazing things will happen. First, it'll sell quicker. If it sells quicker, that means you save money. Second, it'll appraise for more, which many times in itself will cover the cost of the extra work you do on it. And thirdly, you'll sleep better at night. Your buyers will send you customers, and you have a good reputation will spread quickly rather than a bad one. And your neighbors will send you customers, or in fact, they very well may want to talk to you about buying their house when they see what kind of work you've done on the one next door. And your attitude will improve because you'll enjoy dealing with buyers more because you know you have a good product and they'll be raving about it rather than complaining about it. And you'll save extra money you spend on holding costs, so in reality, all these benefits are absolutely free. And heck, it might even improve your sex life. Think about it. More sales means more money. More money means happier spouse, and happier spouse means more frequent and better sex. At least that's what they told me on Oprah the other day. Okay, let's go down to number two, poor area. Second reason houses don't sell. Well, if it's in a poor area, you're going to have a difficult time getting people who can qualify for loans to want to live there. So in other words, is the house in a war zone? And what I mean by war zones is the low-income areas where drugs are normal and prostitution is normal, areas where you may want to go into in the daytime, but you wouldn't ever think about going into them in the nighttime, and if you did, you certainly wouldn't stop. There's most every major city has war zones, and I'm not telling you there's not money in war zones. There is. But it's not where I would want to be renovating properties and trying to sell them to people who can qualify for loans. Now, war zones are good for wholesaling. War zones are good for being in the low-income rental business, but they're not good to sell to qualified buyers. So if you're having trouble selling your property and you're expecting to attract a qualified buyer, is it in a war zone? Is it in a zone where people do not feel safe and therefore will not buy and go elsewhere if they can qualify for a loan? And low-income areas, in the low-income areas, it's critical that you master the art of financing. So you will not survive if you're looking to do buy and sell properties in the war zone and you have to cash out 100%. In other words, your buyers have to be qualified buyers because that is not going to happen. Now, there's some good news about war zones, though. First of all, you can make some large spreads on these houses because you can buy them dirt cheap at prices that you have probably never dreamed you could buy a piece of property for if you haven't been in this business very long. Secondly, most of your competitors won't touch them. Third, they're easy to find and easy to buy. Easy to buy properties in a war zone. I mean, there's just a bunch of them there, and the costs are cheap enough to where the buyers are more scarce and you can get some really good deals. At today's interest rates, buyers can qualify with very, very small incomes. And, anybody who has a job can probably qualify for one of these properties if you can get them interested enough in it and work with them to make them want to live in the property. And again, that's going to be more difficult if it's an unsafe area. Financing is plentiful, and a lot of financing with little or no down payment. That's because these are mostly first-time home buyers you're going to be selling to. And, of course, you can always wholesale if rehabbing doesn't become feasible for you. So I'm not saying you can't do business in the war zones, but I am saying you should absolutely know your exit strategy before you go in the entrance and don't expect to retail these things and make sure that you're buy them cheap enough that you can wholesale them if it doesn't work out. Now, here's the bad news about war zones. Number one, vandalism is normal for you to renovate houses. I mean, before I learned better, I started renovating houses in the war zones back in the early 80s. And gosh, while my crew was in the house fixing something in the back of the house, the neighbors were in the house stealing their tools from the front of the house. And then, of course, what we fixed one day got stolen that night, and we had to go back and fix it again. So if vandalism is going to keep you awake at night, you certainly don't want to be renovating properties in the war zones. Number two, you'll have to screen out a lot of bad buyers in order to get to the handful of good buyers. You'll have a lot of applicants for properties in these areas, but they most of them will have no credit or money to work with, so they're pretty much a waste of your time. More bad news is you're going to be tempted to break the law by falsifying down payments because most of your buyers are broke, and that's the only way you're going to think you can get the property sold is to rig the deal so that you can get them qualified. It's a very big temptation, and I'm not going to tell you that it's not normal out there in the industry because, to be honest with you, most people in the war zone or low-income business in some form or another probably are guilty of falsifying some part of the process to sell the properties and knowingly or unknowingly are committing lender fraud just to get the property sold and get this thing off their back. Don't do it. You should not get involved with that. If you do, it could come back and create a lot of problems for you that will greatly override any profit you make. Next, you're going to have to take back an awful lot of second mortgages if you sell properties in the war zones, and most of them are going to default. That's just the nature of the beast. If you sell a property for $80,000 and take back a $8,000 mortgage just to get the property sold because the buyer won't qualify for a loan high enough to get you cashed out, you're probably going to never collect that because, frankly, the people that buy in these low-income war zones that need the most help are the biggest problem. They're the ones that have the highest default rate, and I'm not telling you that that's not something you should do because usually when you sell one of these low-income properties in one of these areas, you don't care about the second mortgage. You're more interested in getting the cash from the first mortgage if you never get paid on the second. But you're going to have a difficult time running a low-income business in the war zone without having to take back second mortgages in order to get them sold. And don't rehab in the war zone unless you know where to get the buyer financed, and you can live with the vandalism and the second mortgages and all the grief that comes along with being in that part of the business. Of course, I painted a bleak picture there, but I got to tell you that I made an awful lot of money in the war zones. I've done hundreds of houses in these low-income deals, and anywhere from $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 profit on each. So if you can put up with the grief, it might very well make sense if you understand the business and are willing to work with it and can maneuver accordingly. Number three, the third reason why properties don't sell quickly is that they're overpriced. But I want to caution you on that. Overpriced isn't what you probably think it is. And frankly, most of my houses are overpriced, at least what most people think, and I'm proud of it, in case anyone asks. So you should always set your sales price higher than what the house will appraise for. I don't sell houses for what they're appraised for. I sell them for what they're about to be appraised for. I decide what my property is worth. I put it on the market for the number that I name, and if the market agrees, the market will come and pay that price. And I've discovered a long time ago that it makes no difference what somebody else thinks my property is for unless they happen to be a ready, willing, and able buyer. But so I learned that instead of lowering the price, instead of setting the price lower than what I thought it would appraise for, because some people think that's the way you sell a house, I discovered that that the opposite is true. In fact, if you want to sell a house, just raise it until it's gone. And I learned that lesson a long time ago, and consequently, I make an awful lot of money because I actually charge more for my houses rather than less. And 8 out of 10 times, I will get more rather than less just simply because I'm asking for it. And keep in mind, if you're going to deal in the lower end of the market, the sales price is really not the issue. Most of the buyers are only interested in how much do I have to put down, how much do I pay per month, and when do I move in. But there's a limit to this raising the price thing. You can't go nuts on me here. Putting a $125,000 price on a $100,000 house is kind of pushing the envelope. However, putting a price of $109,900 on that $100,000 house, or possibly even $114,900, if it's in a hot area, very well may work. I have people all the time wanting to argue this with me. They say, well, gosh, what if they don't come in and pay the $109,900? Well, as far as I'm concerned, I can always lower the price. But once I name the $100,000 price, I never can raise it to $109,900. And I've told you from a lot of experience that I will get the $109,900 most of the time, and even in the times when I don't get it, I rarely will lower it down to the $100,000. I'll get somewhere in between. Because if I say it's worth $109,900 and my buyer agrees with me, then by golly, that's exactly what it's worth. And you might be asking, well, how you get it appraised for that? The answer is very simple. If I put it on the market for $109.9 and the lender gets an application for $109.9 sales price, they will order the appraisal and tell the appraiser that it's sold for $109.9, and that appraiser will do everything possible to make sure that it comes back for that, at least that, so that they don't kill the deal and have to listen to everybody complaining about it. An appraiser has a leeway in what they appraise a house for. They have discretion, and when they have a buyer that says that they'll pay $109.9, that gives them all the reason in the world to justify that price. Besides, I can send 5 appraisers to a piece of property and get 5 different answers from those appraisals, at least 10% off one way or another. So, again, an appraiser is an opinion of value. And if my buyer says it's worth $109.9, that appraiser is going to be more apt to agree with that buyer. Always charge more. Remember, though, that's assuming that they're in excellent condition, and I'm not afraid to charge more because I'm proud of the property that I put on the market. Warning, however, make sure that the price is the problem before you go fixing what ain't broke. Only your buyer can tell you if the price is too high, not your spouse or your neighbor or your brother-in-law or your mother-in-law or even your realtor. If I had $100 every time a realtor told me the price was too high, I'd be in a higher tax bracket. Well, actually, that's not true. They don't get any higher. You can always lower the price. You can't raise it once it leaves your lips. And I don't know for sure, but I bet I haven't lowered the price on 15% of the houses that I've sold in my entire life, less than what I've asked for. As a rule, 10% above appraisal or at least 10% above good comparable comps in the area is the upper limit. So you try pushing that and you are really stretching the envelope. Now, you'll have to decide based on the area and the condition and the sellability and the heat of the market. Some of you folks listening to this right now are in markets where it's really, really hot. I mean, it's a seller's market. And anytime you got a seller's market and it's in a hot area, I mean, that just gives you a license to raise the price and you'll most likely get it. But I'll tell you, most of the properties that I've sold are not in hot times or in hot areas. And I've been raising my price now for about 15 years, regardless of the market. And I've been doing very well. In fact, I make more money per year from the difference between what I charge and what I'm supposed to charge by conventional wisdom. Just from that difference, forget the rest of the profit. I make more money just by raising my price than most people make working 50 weeks a year swapping hours for dollars at even a very high paid job. So remember, don't sell a house for what it's worth. Sell it for what it's about to be worth. And just raise the price until it's gone, and don't listen to the morons that tell you the way to sell a house is to lower the price. Okay, reason number 4, salesperson's personality problem. Boy, this is a big one. Have you ever talked to a seller or a realtor that you didn't like? Like a mean-spirited, grouchy personality, perhaps. Or how about someone that just won't shut up long enough for you to ask a question? Or maybe you've encountered the pre-screener type who treats you like the enemy until you pass their qualification test. Or how about all those times where you get the wife on the phone and she was afraid to speak without her husband's permission or vice versa? That doesn't even count the ones who do talk but never say anything. And then there's the clueless spouse who can't even tell you the asking price, much less the other details. And sometimes I wonder if these folks ever talk. How about the couple in the middle of a divorce and they talk like you're the one who just slept with their spouse and the reason for all of their problems? Or how about the know-it-all? You know, the kind who wants to do a seminar for you on the phone to impress you with their intelligence on the art of real estate. They can't sell their own house, but they can sure tell you how to sell them and give you a lesson in real estate. And, of course, we can't forget all the thinker brains or the analytical types that are trying to sell to reptile brains, which is the opposite personality. When you get two opposite personalities together, it's going to be a tough sale. Or the sellers who are in love with their houses, where it takes them 30 minutes to describe every little detail while you're trying to stay awake. Gosh, I'm getting depressed just talking about this stuff. I don't think I ever want to talk to another seller again. No, just kidding. Just kidding. Well, actually, I'm not kidding. In my world, I don't talk to sellers and buyers. I've got my system on autopilot, and in fact, we're going to be spending the next couple of lessons talking about putting your selling machine on autopilot, so that you don't have to talk to people you shouldn't be talking to either. And in fact, in time, you'll learn to sell houses without ever talking to prospects until they've seen the house and been pre-screened before they ever come into your life. That's the way we sell houses, so we don't spend our life sucked up into the telephone talking to worthless prospects all day long and have the cell phone surgically implanted in our skulls. The key is for you not to become like one of those people I just described. If you're selling a house, you can't be a seller that has all those problems that we just discussed. And if you already are, you can fix it once you identify it. Here's a hot tip for you. When you're talking to people, whether you're talking to sellers or buyers for that matter, record your calls and listen to yourself selling your house or listen to yourself talking to a seller. If you play back your recording and there was a moron on the phone, you probably can listen to it again and get a real good clue of who that moron was. I'll tell you, the best way to clean up your conversation ability is to record these calls, play them back. You will be absolutely shocked when you learn how much you didn't hear the other party saying because you were trying to think of what to say next, and it'll amaze you about how crummy of a job you'd done that you're not aware of because you didn't know all that stuff you said when you were talking. You just don't recognize your own bad speech habits, like, you know, way too many you knows or ums and things like that. And you'll clean up your conversation abilities quickly if you just go down to Radio Shack and get a little $5 or $6 device that plugs into the end of a tape recorder, and the other suction cup sticks on the back of your handpiece on your telephone. That's all it takes. Those things make a nice recording, and start recording these calls and play them back to yourself. And it'll amaze you how fast you'll improve. Just remember this. Every single time you talk to a buyer, you must sound friendly, flexible, and excited, even if you have to force yourself. And don't be one of those grouchy people on the telephone. Be somebody fun to talk to, somebody exciting to talk to, and somebody that gives hope to the prospect on the other end of the phone. And if that doesn't seem like something you can do, the smartest thing for you to do is just to get somebody else taking the calls for you. Okay, the fifth reason why houses don't sell quickly is the inflexibility of the seller. That means that most sellers can only see one way to sell a house, and if that isn't happening, the house will sit and sit and sit until the perfect buyer comes along. Finding an A-credit buyer to cash you out isn't the only answer. This is especially true for low-income houses where A-credit buyers are scarce. The more you know about the different exits, the easier it will become for you to get flexible. If you don't have your money in the deal and you can live another week without the cash from the sale, it frees you up to get creative and to look for other alternatives. And here's a newsflash for you. It's your job to find a buyer who loves your house and then find a way to get them financed. That's your responsibility if you want to be in the business of selling houses. Can't be like everybody else out there looking for the perfect buyer, trying to put that round peg in that round hole. You've got to develop the ability of putting a square peg in a round hole, and then you'll discover these houses will move at lightning speed when you get flexible. That means sometimes you got to know a little bit more about financing. It's not a perfect world. Bend a little. In fact, here's a short list of selling methods that you may consider. Number one, you can always sell to a qualified buyer and cash out now. That's what everybody's looking for. That's what every builder and realtor in the country is looking for, is that perfect buyer who can put up a down payment and go get a loan. However, you got to know that makes up about 35 to 36% of the total market looking to buy houses. That means that 65% of the people out there buying houses are not going to be that perfect A buyer. They got some kind of a problem they need help with. And if you can figure out how to get them financed, that means you got 65% of the market all to yourself. Most of the business that I've done in my last 22 years in this business, most of the people that we've sold houses to, probably at least 80% of those folks, have been what we call B or C buyers. They're not the perfect A buyers. And because we learned how to get them financed, and we use some of these tools that I'm talking about right now to get them in the property. The second way is to lease option it to your tenant buyer and let them cash out later. In other words, what if they got a little credit problem? If you can structure your business so that you can put them in the house, get a few $1,000 deposit from them up front that's non-refundable, let them pay rent until they fix whatever problem they got. It'll free you up to create a much bigger business because you're not sitting around with vacant houses waiting for that perfect buyer to come along and cash you out and pay a holding cost while you're doing it. In fact, as I'm doing this lesson today, tomorrow I'm closing on a lease purchase deal that I put a tenant buyer in about 10 months ago. And I just got a call today that I'm going to get cashed out on that property tomorrow. Didn't even know that they were applying for a loan. They've been making their rent payments right on time. They're buying my property for $185,000. and I think I owe something like $120 on it. So I'm going to get a nice little paycheck at the end of this week that I didn't even know that I was going to get because I was not in a hurry, and I let that tenant buyer buy when they wanted to buy. They gave me $5,000 when they moved in. They've been paying more rent than I've been making out on a payment. Frankly, I didn't even care if they bought or not. And truthfully, I hope something goes wrong and they don't close on the house because it's going up in value all the time. But what the heck, I'll just go out and buy another one to replace it with. So I just have to take this cash and just find something to do with it. Oh, the problems of a real estate entrepreneur. Third way is to sell with owner financing and help the buyer get financed later. That works exactly like a lease option does. You put them in the property, you let them live there, you let them make payments, and in this case, they actually buy it. You become the bank. But when you sell with owner financing, it doesn't have to be a long-term deal. You can always make it a short-term balloon in there to force them to pay you off within a year or two or whatever. Thirdly, and this one will probably be new to you, but you can always sell with owner financing and then sell off that mortgage or trust deed that you took back the day you closed the sale or shortly thereafter. In other words, I don't have to go out and get somebody a loan to buy a house. I can always sell or finance it myself. And what I've learned over the years is if there are companies out there who will buy that note from you, now you'll take a little discount, 6 or 7%, but that discount won't be any bigger than the closing costs you're going to pay selling it traditionally. So I have the ability to sell houses with owner financing, advertising with owner financing, bring in buyers that are not A buyers, create owner financing back to me, and then if I choose, sell that note right then and there or any time thereafter for that matter for almost face value of the note, therefore creating cash to me. And if you don't have any idea what I just said, don't worry about it. I wouldn't expect you to latch onto that technique quickly, but the more you learn about financing, the more you're going to like that technique. In fact, we expand on that a whole day. We spend a whole day teaching that technique alone in our paper power, our 3-day paper power class that we do 2 or 3 times a year here at Global Publishing. Another way, and this is quite common in the low end of the spectrum. If you're doing low income houses, this is the way that most of them are going to get sold, and that's to get a buyer a loan for somewhere between 80 and 90% of the sales price. Get whatever they got down and then take back a second mortgage for the difference. It's quite common for me to take back a second mortgage for anywhere from 5 to 15% of the sales price because the buyer won't qualify for a 95, 97, 100% loan. If they got credit problems, all the lenders do to compensate is to lower the loan-to-value ratio. So if I'm selling a $100,000 house, instead of me getting them a $97,000 loan on an FHA deal and then bringing in $3,000, they may not qualify for that type of loan, so the lender will raise their interest rate some and lower their loan-to-value. So I might go get them an $85,000 loan, for example, on my $100,000 deal, take their $3,000 down payment, and take back a $12,000 second mortgage. 85 plus 3 is 88, plus 12 is 100. So instead of getting cashed out, I got cash mostly out with my $88,000 that I received, and I got a $12,000 free second mortgage out of this thing that I don't have any money in. I may or may not collect the payments on it, but I can do all kinds of things with that second, like trade it for other stuff or just numerous things. In fact, that's how I got a motorhome one time. I traded 5 of those little second mortgages for a free and clear motorhome. Had that motorhome for 5 years, drove it a couple times, and sold it for a fraction of what I gave away to get it. But hey, it was a free motorhome, and just for the record, if you're going to have a motorhome, make sure it's a free one. And also remember that if I'm selling a house that I've renovated, I'm probably going to raise the price on it about 10% anyway. So if I have to take back a 10% second mortgage on it, what the heck? It's free money. I'm just taking back a second mortgage for the amount that I raised the price instead of selling it for cash at the price most people would sell it for anyway. I hope you got part of that. If you didn't, hey, don't worry about it. I understand. Sometimes this financing stuff takes a little bit of time to grasp. Okay, number 6, the 6th reason why houses don't sell quickly is the salesperson's lack of knowledge about financing programs available, much of which is what I just discussed, but no, it ain't. We're not talking about the same thing I just said. If you're going to master your craft of selling houses, you just have to learn a little bit about financing programs. What will kill loans? What programs require little or no down payment? What credit can be fixed and what can't? And what will the lender want fixed on the house before it's closed? And who will let me take back a second, and who won't let me take back a second? And a few other questions that you're going to need along the way, but don't worry, you'll get them answered as you go. And by the way, just for the record, in case you didn't know it, you can literally put people in houses and get them 100% financing, because there's companies out there that will actually provide grants for down payments. And so if you bring me somebody with a job and income and something that even smells like credit, and I'll show you a way to get them in the house. So I'm not expecting you to be a financing expert, but the more you learn on this, the easier it's going to get, and you really need to take time to learn the basics. But probably the easiest way to learn the basics is to get out there and get some deals and talk to mortgage brokers or our mortgage lenders as you go along, and pick their brains, and they'll help you with what works and what doesn't work. Then when you get an interested prospect, it's simply a matter of getting the buyer's information to the lender of your choice and letting them tell you what'll work. See, I don't pull credit. We don't have a machine in our office. We just don't do that junk. We get somebody who wants to buy our property. We let the mortgage brokers pull the credit for us and tell us what kind of a loan they can get them, and then we work with what they say. I'm not in the financing business. I'm not in the lending business, and I don't intend to be. But just by simply buying and selling properties, you will learn the ropes just by osmosis. In fact, I will tell you right now that if you'll just take a little bit of time and learn a little bit about financing, you'll already be giant leaps ahead of most of your competition, because they just won't take the time to do this. I guess they feel that they're too good or too smart to humble themselves and actually ask for help. My friend, what you don't know about or what you knew about financing a year ago is going to change. I mean, financing constantly changes. It changes almost monthly. So the only way you're going to keep up is to keep buying and selling houses, and as you're doing that, you'll learn the ropes as you go, just automatically, because the mortgage brokers will tell you what's worked, what's changed, what's new, and so forth. And I guess it probably won't take long before you find two or three of these mortgage brokers and put them on your dream team. And when you get involved in our system here at Global, we're going to guide you to the right people anyway and make life a lot easier for you instead of having to make you go out there and scout them out on your own. Okay, reason number 7, why houses don't sell quickly, is the salesperson's lack of knowledge about attracting and pre-screening leads. And this is a big one. First step of selling houses is to locate prospects. And if not a good job is not being done of locating prospects, all the rest of the stuff we're talking about here isn't going to matter much, because we have to find people who are interested in buying our property. And without potential buyers, it's kind of hard to sell houses. Frankly, an ad in the newspaper and or signs should be enough to attract plenty of prospects if you know how to write the ad and where to put and how to use signs. I can't turn this into an ad writing course, but any ad that gets prospects to call is a good one, and any ad that doesn't is a bad one, or it's in the wrong publication. So make sure your ad gives the prospect a reason to call. Try to include a unique selling proposition, or what we call a USP. What you can offer that everyone else doesn't, for example. Here's some key phrases that we use quite often. Things like lease purchase, or no qualifying owner financing, or no bank qualification, or sometimes no money needed, or easy terms, or owner will help, or will accept anything on trade. There's one I really like to use. That really gets the curiosity stimulated in the marketplace. And they ask me, well, what do you mean we'll take anything on trade? I say, well, what you got? Because I will take anything on trade. Can't tell you how much stuff I've taken in on trade on houses over the years, because it's all free. I mean, cars and boats and trucks and motorhomes and mobile homes and services and anything and everything. And just so you'll know, that it's acceptable to the lender to take items in on trade in exchange for money for the down payment. So if I were you, I'd always put that in my ads. We'll accept anything on trade. Owner will help. I put that in there quite often. They call and say, what does that mean? I say, well, what kind of help do you need? I'm the owner. I'll help you. All that is a reason to get them to call. And sometimes we put in no down payment. It's especially important on the low-income properties, because, in fact, there's so much money out there to finance people in these low-income first-time home buyers that it's easy to get people in properties with no down payment if they have anything even resembling credit, and especially if you're willing to take back second mortgages. Some students use flyers distributed in newspapers and don't run ads, and others use a lot of signs and referrals and mail-outs and the Internet and broadcast, voice broadcasting, and various other things. But I'll tell you, the thing that has worked for me the best, the thing that works for my students the best, regardless of where you live, regardless of what area of the country you're in, regardless of whether you're dealing in lower-priced properties or higher-priced properties, you always want to use signage. And, in fact, quite often, I will put signs, use signs correctly, and never have to run an ad. Because the number one thing in selling houses that attracts the most leads are signs. But there's a trick to signs. You've got to do it correctly, and here's the way you do it. Of course, you want a for sale by owner sign in the front yard. And if any of these terms that I just stated apply, like lease purchase or no qualifying financing or any of that, you want that on your signs. Any of these keywords, it'll get people to call. But the key to the signage is not the one in the front yard. The key is the pointer signs pointing people to the property. When you put a house on the market, you should have at least 15 to 20 little pointer signs pointing from all directions, driving people to the property. And without them, I promise you, your lead flow is going to cut itself down to about a fourth or a third of what it is with them. You will get more calls from pointer signs than you will running all the ads in the world, doing all the other things you can do. The downside is that they come up missing, and they come up missing a lot. So you're going to have to go out there at least once a week and put pointer signs out. Make sure that your phone number is on the pointer signs, because if you don't, your competition is going to appreciate you supplying them with a bunch of signs. Besides that, your phone number has got to be on the signs, because quite a lot of the people will call the phone number to get information on the house and will not take the time to deter from their path and find the property. So just make a note, pointer signs. You will get 3 calls, 4 signs for every 1 call on an ad as a rule. But the key is to make sure that you keep a good flow of leads coming in until the house is sold. Where most people fail is how they handle the leads once they come in. And that, my friend, is by far the weakest link in the chain. Let's assume that you're successful in driving in leads. And incidentally, when people tell me they're having a hard time selling a property, the first thing that I ask them is, well, how many people have called about your house this week? And if they tell me, well, 1 or 2, I instantly know what the problem is. The problem is that they need to crank up the lead machine and get more people calling them. It's that simple. You can't sell a house when you're getting 1 or 2 calls a week. You need to get more calls coming in, regardless of what it takes. If you put out the signs and they don't work, run some ads. And then if you can't get enough calls, do some direct mail, do some flyers, do whatever you got to do to get the machine cranked up. But the leads must be pre-screened properly, and the good ones work almost daily. And I'll tell you, out of any batch of leads that you create, you will usually come up with some qualified prospects. And again, the more flexible you get on your financing, the bigger, the broader base the word qualified covers, because qualified to me might not mean the same as qualified to you. Maybe not with A credit, but qualified if you're flexible, as we discussed earlier. And what I look for most, actually, are people who love the house and are excited about owning it. You give me someone who loves the house and raves about it and just convinces me that they want to get in it, and give me a little something to work with. And by a little something, I mean at least some resemblance of credit, and preferably good, not bad, and some income to pay the payment with, and maybe even some down payment. You give me credit or a down payment, and I'll promise you I'll find a way to finance that individual. If they got credit, easy, I'd take them in and get them a loan, some kind of a loan. If they got a down payment and it's big enough to satisfy me, I'll put them in there on a lease purchase. I don't care what their credit looks like, to a degree. So give me something to work with, give me somebody who loves the house, and I'll show you a way to get them in the house. And that's the way I run my business, and that's why houses don't sit around very long. And that's the way my most successful students run their business, instead of trying to cash out everything to get their hands on. And incidentally, if you crank up your buying machine, regardless of the words you use in your ads, even if they say no down or easy terms or any of those things that I've discussed earlier, just by plain old pure numbers game, you're going to attract some A buyers in the process. In fact, I got to tell you, the last time I ran the no money needed ad, I sold a house for $89,900 and the guy put up $28,000. My ad said no money needed. fact, I asked him why he called on an ad. He said, well, I just thought it was an ad that I ought to call on to find out what it was all about. He ended up putting up a $28,000 down payment. So just keep in mind, it doesn't make any difference what your ad says. It matters how you handle that lead when they call. And the purpose of any ad or any piece of advertising is to get the phone to ring. And that's all it does. It does not sell the property. It gets the phone to ring. Okay, reason number eight as to why houses don't sell quickly is no follow-up system in place. The easiest way to sell houses is to work a buyer's list that you built from the last one you sold. If you have more buyers than houses, you don't have to run ads or put out flyers or send out letters or do any of that other stuff. You just pick up the phone and call the prospects you pre-screened from the last time that you ran the ad and work them. Tell them, go out and take a look at a house. I got another one for you. And lo and behold, you send two or three people out the house and you got a buyer and you don't even have to do any of that stuff. And it looks to me like that's a lot easier to suffer the pain of creating a buyer's list once than talking to dozens of prospects from ads every time you get a house ready to sell. You don't have to be an organizational wizard to implement a little follow-up program and create a buyer's list. In fact, a pile of pre-screened buyers on the corner of your desk with no system or no filing system or no separation is certainly a lot better than nothing. And in fact, that sounds like my system. Well, that's actually not true. At least I have a file folder where I put these things in. If I could just find the file folder. I know it's around here somewhere. Okay, reason number nine, functional obsolescence. That's a cutesy term. And all that means is that the house has got a problem, not a people problem. And many times you can't fix functional obsolescence. So the smartest thing to do is recognize it going in, which frankly, I don't think is going to be difficult. I think your senses will steer you away from functional obsolescence if you open your eyes and just take a look at the property. You will discover things like extremely small rooms. Look, if they're so small they turn you off, they're probably going to turn your buyers off too. Or here's one where you've got a kitchen that's got a bathroom off of it. Anytime you got a bathroom off of a kitchen, you got functional obsolescence. And you're going to have a tough time marketing that property if you can't fix that functional obsolescence. Here's another one when you have to walk through a bedroom to get to a bathroom and it's the only bath in the house. Believe me, that's functional obsolescence and you're going to have a miserable time getting that house sold if I have to go through somebody else's bedroom to go to the bathroom. Low ceilings. If you have ceilings under 7 feet, for one thing, FHA won't finance them. For another thing, most people won't want the house anyway unless they're mighty short people because that's just an oddball house. Most ceilings are at least 8 feet tall, and, I mean, it's obvious the minute you walk in the house. The house is added on unprofessionally. If the house was added on unprofessionally, it's easy to recognize, and it just may create a mess of a layout plan and just turn people off. It turns you off. Remember, it's probably going to turn them off. Or it's a strange layout that can't be fixed. Boy, I've been in a lot of houses with weird layouts in them, and I recognized immediately that this place is weird, and I probably don't want to get involved in it. Or maybe it's adjacent to odors, smells, bad smells. I remember in Jacksonville, we got an area where we have a Gleaton paint factory in, where they make paint, and anywhere around that entire paint factory, it's just got an awful odor. And that whole area there is just a bad area to do business in because some people just can't take the stink. Of course, some people just got used to it, and of course, they're living in houses there. But I wouldn't want to overcome that. I tried a couple of times, and those houses were tough to sell. Of course, I got a bush beer plant here, too, now, and that smells like boiled peanuts all the time, which I kind of like, but I wouldn't count on selling that houses to people who like the smell of boiled peanuts, which actually is hops when they're cooking them. Or if it's next door to commercial property, for example. I've had properties next door to little shopping centers, next door to convenience stores or laundromats, and every time I've had a property like that, it was tough to sell. People just don't want their house located next to a laundromat. Or, in fact, even next door to a school for the most part. I used to think that was a plus, but I've had more trouble selling houses next to schools than I have when they're not next to schools. You know, I used to think, teachers all love living here. Well, that's actually not the truth. The teachers want to get as far away from those kids as they can when they get out of school. So I learned a lesson on that one. Or a bad foundation, or no foundation. I've literally had houses where the house was sitting on the ground with no foundation under them. And you can recognize that in a minute. It just means somebody did a crummy job of building it. And and you just want to stay away from it. Your senses will guide you. Just follow your nose and look for things that are obvious to you, because if they're obvious to you, they're obvious to other folks. Now, that's just a few of the things that I can think of now as far as functional obsolescence goes. Sometimes you can correct them, and sometimes you can't. If you can't, if it bothers you, just pass. There's plenty of houses out there. Okay, reason number 10 why houses don't sell, and that is that the house is very small. I guess this is also functional obsolescence in a way, but it's very common. Anytime a house has less than 1,000 square feet in it, I get cautious. And I've learned that houses under 1,000 square feet normally are hard to sell, and they're just not much you can do but keep looking for small families with one or two people in them. Now, I'm not saying that they won't sell. In fact, I've had a lot of them, hundreds of them. I'm just saying that they're harder to sell. And I much prefer houses that are larger rather than smaller. Like, I've got a couple right now. Kind of think about it. I've got a little two-bedroom, 850-square-foot house that, it just took several months to get somebody in that house, and it's been a pain ever since I bought it. But, hey, if you buy them cheap enough, I'm not saying don't buy them. I'm just saying, but you got to buy them cheap. If you're going to buy these small houses, you just got to buy them so cheap that you can always wholesale them, because if you get in them and you have a hard time retailing them, or you choose not to, just make sure that you bought them cheap enough so that you can wholesale them quickly and get out of them and let somebody else worry about the size of it and give them a good deal accordingly. There's always a buyer for a house, even if it's a small one. All right, reason number 11 why houses don't sell. Salesperson loses control of the loan process. Yes, I said salesperson, and yes, I said that is the salesperson's responsibility, meaning you, the seller, in most cases, is in control of the loan process. And you must remain in control from the moment you buy the house until you get the check. And that includes the loan process. You decide who your buyer goes to for the loan. You decide who appraises the house and who gets a survey and a termite report and who closes it. You pick all of those. You're in charge of speeding up the loan. You're in charge of the process all the way through from beginning to end. Of course, you're going to have a loan processor involved in it, but most of the decisions that are going to get made should be your decisions, so they go your way. Yep, you're not the lender, but you should check in every few days and push for results and round up missing paperwork. If you don't, the close will drag on forever. I mean, like, would you allow your boss to hold your paycheck for 2 or 3 weeks until he decides to pay you? Well, that's exactly what you're doing when you let a loan processor jerk your chain. So the next time you lose a buyer because he or she didn't close quick enough, go to the bathroom mirror and cuss out the right person responsible. That would be you. The last time I lost a buyer 2 days before closing, it was because God told them not to buy. And if I'd been 2 days earlier, maybe I wouldn't have been competing with God on that deal. It doesn't matter. 6 weeks later, I sold the house for $3,000 more than I did the first time anyway, so maybe I wasn't competing with God after all. All right, reason number 12 why houses don't sell. The house is located too far away from the city. And that's an easy one to fix. Just don't buy it, unless you want to create a lot of driving time so you can listen to more of my tapes, maybe. Frankly, I don't buy anything I intend to retail that's more than 30 minutes from my house or my office. Of course, I know for some people in the big cities, that's about 3 blocks away, but hey, you can always move. My philosophy is if it's way out in the country and you need a AAA map and you got to pack a picnic lunch to go see it, probably the best thing you can do is steer away from it and not buy it. Just trust your gut on this one. Reason number 13 why houses don't sell quickly, and that is that the house is in a high price range where few buyers can afford. Now, sometimes that has no bearing on it because the market is hot and high price range houses are normal. If it is, the high value is not an excuse for the slow sale. The problem is elsewhere on this list. But in smaller cities where a $500,000 house is the mansion on the hill that you expect the governor to live in, you certainly can expect problems selling that property if there aren't very many in that price range in that city. All that makes a case for you to not guarantee monthly payments or personal debt or take big risks on these deals. Unless you're a sadist and looking for pain, you shouldn't try to outguess the market. Don't count on a high-priced house selling quickly just because you like it. You got to remove the risk. You got to learn how to do this business correctly. Give yourself a little time, and you'll discover that the big ones sell just like the little ones, but hopefully with a lot more profit. And here's a word of caution. You'd better make sure you have a large spread on these big babies. Buyers of $500,000 houses and up are more sophisticated and more apt to ask for a price reduction. This is one time we're raising the price. You're probably not going to get away with it unless you really have a hot property in a hot market. And these price ranges, you probably will have to lower the price below what they'll appraise for to get them sold, at least sold quickly. The good news is these folks can usually qualify for a loan, and the majority of the sales are all cash with new financing. Well, owner financing and lease purchase just doesn't have the sizzle in this end of the market as it does in the lower end. They expect to go out and get a loan, they expect to pay cash, and they expect to do it the old traditional way. That doesn't mean it's not used, it's just not used as often. In fact, I and a lot of my students are specializing in upper-end houses right now and getting six-figure profit checks from some of these babies. And I'm really loving this part of the business. Once you learn how to reverse your risk and sell quickly, it'll become apparent real fast that the more dollars you waller in, the more stick to you. We just had a couple of houses here sell this week of mine, and one of those houses netted us a $69,000 profit check, and the other one netted us pretty darn close. And these were houses that were in the, one of them was a $445,000 sale, and the other one was about a $350,000 sale. And I've got several deals right now that I'm working on with students throughout the country that will have well over six-figure paychecks on one house. Too many to describe in this conversation right now, but I'm working the higher end properties. We're trying to specialize in them, and I am absolutely loving them because it's the same amount of work. In fact, sometimes it's a lot less work for a lot bigger paychecks. So if you want to get into the high house business, you might want to look into attending my Massive Income Strategies 5-day event where we talk about a lot about structuring deals on high price and low house low priced houses as well, and removing your risk and all the things that are involved in that, and especially how to exit from these things using auctions like we're doing all over the country with some of these high-end stuff. Massive Income Strategies event is the one that I personally teach. You can find it by going to ronlegrand.com. I teach it four times a year and only four times a year, and it's pretty usually sold out well in advance. Okay, reason number 14, the last one on our list on why houses won't sell quickly, and that is because they only have one bathroom. Now, I've sold hundreds of houses with only one bath, but it's certainly not my preference. Cheap houses, not a problem. Houses above $100,000 or so, it's going to be very difficult. For houses much above $100,000, almost impossible. People who can pay more want more, and so if you can't add a bath, you may wish to consider not buying if you feel it's important to the sale. Now, I have never added a bathroom onto a house by adding a room. Now, I have added to some bathrooms in houses where there were room already in it, and I just had to use an existing room to add a bath. But the only time I've ever added a bath, I've used the existing structure. And if you do, adding a bathroom shouldn't cost you more than $2,000 or $3,000. And sometimes that may be worth it. But I'll tell you, trying to sell a four-bedroom, one-bath house ain't going to be easy. Selling a three-bedroom, one-bath house, that's okay as long as the house is small and on the low end. Selling a two-bedroom, one-bath house is the norm, and buyers will expect that. But be very careful about buying properties with only one bath in them, because in today's society, people generally look for and expect more than one bathroom. Okay, well, I won't guarantee you that every problem that is out there that you'll run into, reasons not selling houses quickly, are on this list, but my guess is that most of the time they're going to be on here, so the next time you run across a problem selling them, if you do, take a look at this list, and I'll bet you that it's on here somewhere. And I'll tell you this much, wherever there's a problem, there's a solution. And I've had over 1,600 houses in my career. Not one time have I ever had one that didn't sell. It's just a matter of expanding your horizons and learning a little bit more about the selling process.